Yearbook by Seth Rogen. This is the author, Seth Rogen. Strap yourselves in. Bubby and Zadie. I wanted to try stand-up comedy. I imagine if most 12-year-olds told their parents something like that, they'd be met with a healthy dose of skepticism. Fuck. If a 30-year-old told me they wanted to try stand-up comedy, I'd probably do my best to talk them out of it. Which makes it even more incredible that not only did my parents not scoff at the notion of it, they looked in the local newspaper and found a stand-up comedy workshop to enroll me in. I loved comedy growing up, I think, because my parents loved comedy. They would watch SCTV, Billy Crystal stand-up, Ghostbusters, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Uncle Buck, Home Alone, Coming to America, Big, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Back to the Future, The Breakfast Club, When Harry Met Sally, What About Bob, and they would just laugh their fucking asses off, and I would laugh my fucking ass off, and if people were doing this for a living, then I was going to try to be one of those people. The workshop was simple enough. You'd spend a day learning the basic concept of stand-up joke writing. You'd write a few jokes, and then, that night, you'd go to the Lotus Club, a local lesbian bar with what, in retrospect, was a very vaginal flower painted on its awning, and perform your jokes for the lesbians. My mother dropped me off outside. I walked into the class, and not surprisingly, was the only kid. The first of about 1,000 rooms that I would walk into over the next decade where that was the case. I've been the youngest person in the room a lot of my life. There's something nice about having aged into my job, but still, I miss those days because when you're young, the bar for accomplishment is so low, no matter what you do, it's pretty impressive. If you're young enough, just walking is considered a huge deal. My friends are thrilled when their kids don't shit all over their floors. As an adult, I get little to no praise for doing the same. The teacher, a working stand-up comic named Mark Pooley, who looked exactly like Garth from Wayne's World, took the stage.
Nobody wants to hear about what you like. There's nothing less funny than hearing about the stuff you have fun doing. Fun isn't funny. Comedy is pain. It's struggle. So when thinking of what to write about, don't ask yourself, what's funny to me? Ask yourself, what bothers me? What frustrates me? What do I wish I could change? What can I just not fucking stand?
One answer popped into my head. At that point in my life, there was really only one answer. My grandparents. I didn't get along great with them back then. Their real names were Faye and Kelly, but I knew them as Bubby and Zadie. Their last name was Bologus, which is by all means a hilarious last name. I remember being 13, hanging out at a friend's house, and telling him that my mother's maiden name was Bologus. His 9-year-old brother cackled loudly from the other room. Sounds like blow us. It sure does, I thought. It sure does. When I was younger, Bubby and Zadie just didn't seem that into me. I got the impression they liked my older sister, Dania, more than me, mostly because their words and actions made it wildly clear that they did. They were just nicer to her, which didn't really bug me that much because I didn't love spending time with them. They were simultaneously tough and eccentric. My grandmother was born while her family was in a caravan fleeing Poland as World War I was breaking out. She got to pick her own birthday when she was a little girl because her parents didn't know her real one, which is some real Depression-era shit. How rough was Poland for Jews at that time? So rough that when they arrived in Winnipeg, a city in Manitoba that has swarms of mosquitoes throughout the summer and debilitating ice storms throughout the winter, they thought, this place is fucking great. Let's stay here. My grandfather was born in Winnipeg, one of 3 brothers, the others named Curly and Pinky. He played professional football in the CFL and lied about his age to go to war. When I was about 6, we were on a family vacation in Palm Springs and I cracked my toenail when I stubbed it in the pool. My grandfather said he would fix it and then he ripped off the entire nail. We had to go to the hospital. I didn't really start spending a lot of time alone with my grandparents until I was 10 and my sister was 13 getting ready for her bat mitzvah. She had to attend services every Friday and I did not want to do that, so my parents would drop me off at my grandparents' apartment to hang out for a few hours while they went to synagogue with my sister so she could pretend to pray. Every Friday night would play out the same. I would plant myself on Zadie's Lazy Boy and turn on TGIF. ABC's Friday night programming, which consisted of Family Matters, Step by Step, and Hanging with Mr. Cooper, which are all shows that are, by any definition, fucking dope as fuck. My grandparents would make me a turkey sandwich on challah bread and pour me a glass of chocolate milk, and then sit with me as they tried their hardest to follow what the fuck was happening on these shows.
Who's that guy?
He's the dad. Who's the dweeby one?
That's Steve Urkel.
And what's that? A robot?
Yes, Steve Urkel built it.
What's the robot doing now?
It's pretending to be Steve to trick the girl he likes into hooking up with it.
This show has not aged well.
Steve Snorkel?
Urkel.
And what's the show called?
Family Matters.
Family Bladders?
My grandfather worked in the engine room of a battleship in the Royal Navy during World War II and, as a result, was more or less deaf. He loved being in the Navy. He talked about it like most guys talked about their fraternity years. They would hang out, smoke cigars, talk shit, all while floating in thousands of tons of metal around the war-torn Horn of Africa. He arrived at Normandy on D-Day plus one, but his favorite story was about figuring out that if you broke your rationed rum bottle after drinking it, you could say you broke it before and get a double ration. Anyway, he was deaf.
Family crappers?
He's saying family campers.
No, I'm saying family matters.
Stop yelling.
Who's yelling?
You're yelling.
This would play out for about 2 hours straight, and as maddening as spending time with them was, I couldn't help but think they were entertaining. Because they grew up in the Depression, they would steal everything. Every time we went to McDonald's, they would empty the napkin dispenser and put them in a giant box that my grandfather kept in his van. If we were out at dinner and you heard my bubby say, "Oh, this is a nice plate," you knew the next time you ate at their place, you'd be eating off that plate because she straight jacked that shit. Knives, forks, you name it, they swiped it. Another thing I noticed was that my grandmother kind of had a wispy white afro that, when the light hit it, became completely see-through, leaving you with a very good idea of what my grandmother would look like if she was bald. And it was horrifying. I wrote 3 jokes about Bubby and Zadie that followed the basic structure we were taught. Say the premise or the thing you don't like. Say why you don't like that thing by making a humorous observation. And then do an act out, an impression of the target of the joke, bringing it all together. My grandparents were hard to impersonate, so I thought I'd just go with a generic old Jewish person voice. It was a safe but ultimately good call. The night came and my turn to take the stage was fast approaching. I honestly don't remember being that nervous, probably because I was 12 fucking years old and wasn't even mature enough to be nervous. I've definitely gotten more in my head as I've gotten older, and I marvel at how I used to just barrel into these situations without much fear or anxiety. Kids can do that. It's like those very young Chinese acrobats you see, flinging their little bodies in the air, being thrown around, completely unaware of the stakes. If those kids knew what a torn ACL was, they wouldn't be letting those motherfuckers toss their little asses around like that. And if I had known the pain and shame that goes along with putting yourself out there creatively and being rejected, I probably wouldn't have been so excited. But I didn't. So I was. I took the stage. The lesbian's eyes locked on me.
So, people ask me what the hardest part about being Jewish is. The persecution? The repeated attempts at systematic annihilation? Nope. The hardest part about being Jewish is the grandparents.
They laughed. And thank fucking God they did, because if they didn't, I'd be one very frustrated video game store employee right now. I continued.
My grandparents argue all the time, but they're both deaf, so they don't even know what the other one is arguing about.
Time for the big quasi-anti-Semitic act out.
Hey, Kelly, pass me a pillow.
What? I'm an armadillo? Why would you call me this animal? What? I'm not wearing flannel.
Small laugh, but enough to keep going, which could also be the title of this book. I went on.
My grandmother has a thin white afro, and when the light hits her hair a certain way, you can see right through it and she looks bald. It's weird to see what your bubby would look like completely bald. She looks like Gandhi in a pink floral tracksuit.
I finished it off with a joke about the stolen napkins that got a so-so laugh, and then I fucked off. The lesbians loved me. A guy who worked at another comedy room gave me his card and asked if I would perform there next week. All those times I was dreading hanging out with my bubby and Zadie suddenly became something else. Something new. They were fodder. They were material. I also began to suspect that maybe, just maybe, they knew they were being funny. They would come and watch me perform from time to time, and not only did they not mind when I made fun of them, they got pissed off when I didn't.
Where were our jokes? We're not funny anymore?
Don't worry, you're still plenty funny. I gotta make fun of Mom and Dad, too.
Your Mom and Dad aren't as funny as us.
They were really my first significant comedic inspiration. My muse. Or more accurately, my Jews. Or juice. Can books have alts? Seems like it. This joke reads better than it sounds, so bear with me. As they got older, I realized how much they did love me, and I appreciated more and more how genuinely hilarious they were. I started to see that among their friends, my bubby specifically was considered a fucking riot. She swore, she drank, she laughed, she didn't take herself too seriously, but she also wasn't afraid of having hard conversations.
All my friends are dying. The bastards! Don't they know I want to play Mahjong?
I remember when I was around 20, we went to my cousin's bat mitzvah. At this point, my bubby must have been in her mid-80s. My dad thought it would be funny to keep filling her glass of wine whenever she wasn't looking, so she thought she had had two glasses when she had actually downed about 9. She was shit-faced, like drunk college girl shit-faced. We had to carry her out to the car, one arm around me, the other around my dad, as she drunkenly yelled, "I love you guys, you're the greatest!" She puked on the ride home. My bubby never really slowed down. She lived till her late 90s and was for the most part sharp and aware the whole time. Maybe too aware. Aging can be scary, and it seems like a lack of awareness can be a gift sometimes, a gift my bubby never got. "I'm old. I'm going to be gone soon, but it's okay. I'm ready. It's scary, but I think I'm ready. Don't worry," I would say, holding her hand. "I'm going to stuff you and put you in the living room. It'll be like you never left." She would laugh and cry a little at the same time, and so would I. They're both gone now, but they shape me in more ways than I can ever know, and thankfully, in one, I definitely do. I wrote my first jokes about them. When I was about to move to LA to be on Freaks and Geeks, I was getting a lot of advice. People love to give 16-year-olds advice, especially ones who seem to be at the precipice of a new life chapter. My teachers told me to keep up with the curriculum. The stand-ups I knew told me to keep working hard to perform every night if possible. My parents wanted me to stay humble and keep my priorities straight. My friends wanted me to make good stuff that they would want to watch. But it's my bubby's advice I probably think of the most.
"I'm moving to LA."
"Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'm going to be on a TV show, and I'm probably just going to try to stay there to see if I can make it in comedy."
"Oh, yeah?"
"Yeah. So, any advice?"
"Sure."
She took my hand and smiled at me.
"You give those sons of bitches hell."
Bonanza. My dad is from Newark, New Jersey. He somehow manages to be simultaneously bald and always in dire need of a haircut. My mom is from Vancouver, British Columbia. She's overfunctional, but also a Kundalini yoga instructor who exudes peace and calm. As I've touched on, they're both the descendants of Jews who fled people trying to kill their asses in Eastern Europe, which can be said about most Jews in North America, but probably more eloquently. My dad has OCD and Tourette syndrome. He's constantly pacing around, swaying back and forth like a metronome. I also have a very slight case of Tourette's. It's something I actually recognize in a lot of other people who very likely aren't diagnosed and just feel twitchy. I feel twitchy all the time, like I have an itch that needs to be scratched. People with eyebrow furrows, clenching of facial muscles, clearing of the throat, flaring of the nostrils. I get exactly how that feels. For the most part, I can control it, but I notice myself doing some twitchy shit from time to time. My dad never had or wanted a traditional career, and his attitude towards work is refreshing in that he unabashedly hates it. None of his self-worth comes from what he accomplishes from a career standpoint. He thinks being a good person and helping others, something he's done throughout his life to a heroic degree, is a better way to get that, and I wish I had inherited more of that to go along with the uncontrollable eyebrow furrows. I have two half-brothers by lesbian mothers. They were family friends who used my father as a sperm donor. The fact that those women looked at my dad and thought, "Great genetics there," is confounding, but ultimately complimentary. And I'm very glad they did, because my half-brothers are great. Better than I am in most ways, making me feel a bit like some sort of Schwarzenegger-DeVito situation went down with the sperm, But I'm not sure the science behind twins is totally sound, unlike the science behind Junior, which adds up completely. My dad is super specific about a lot of things, but mostly about his socks and his food. He essentially wears the same socks every day, white Champions. Over the years, he noticed that when the socks became mismatched from their original pairs, due to the fact that they all looked the same, you'd wind up with a real variation of socks as far as wear and tear goes. Some socks were thin and aged, some brand new and fluffy, but all were white Champions. It started to bother him that sometimes he'd be wearing socks with greatly varying feel from one foot to the other. So he developed a system. Whenever he bought a new pair of socks, he'd number them. 1, 1, 2, 2, the same number on each foot of the pair of socks. That way, although they all looked the same, he'd be able to maintain consistency when it came to the integrity of his socks from foot to foot. It was a big topic of conversation in my house. It obviously made the process of sorting his laundry way more complicated, so he'd always have to do it himself, and it took him hours. My friends would come over, and he'd be standing over the washing machine, pairing up the socks. Every once in a while, screaming to my mom,
"Have you seen a 7 or a 9? I can't find them."
It was so weird that when my mom's friend saw an ad in the paper that read, "Wanted for documentary, people with bizarre household chore management," they instantly thought of my parents. My dad got it, but my mom was a bit insulted. She was on the phone with her friend.
"Why did you think I would be interesting?"
"Because of Mark's weird sock thing."
"Oh, that makes perfect sense."
"And because of how messy your house is all the time."
Yes, my house was messy. I wouldn't say dirty, but kind of cluttered. There were always little piles of things everywhere. I'm not saying this is a Jewish tendency specifically, but almost every Jewish parent's house I've been to is like this. Nothing is put away. Everything is laid out in organized little stacks that are everywhere. Jews like to see all their belongings. We like to know what we got at all times, just in case we gotta pack up shop and get the fuck out of town. The crew came and filmed my parents talking about housework and got shots of my dad organizing his socks and our little stacks and piles. It seemed like a cheap little Canadian documentary, so none of us really thought about it much. Until my parents started to get recognized on the street by students.
"Holy shit! You're the sock guy! It's the sock guy from the documentary!"
"What do you mean?"
"We saw it in class."
"What class?"
"Sociology class. They show the Chore Wars documentary every year. It really unravels generals when it comes to housework. And that shit with the socks? That's insane!"
It might be a narrow baseline of fans, but among Canadian sociology students, my parents were major celebrities. My parents are passionate about marching and protesting against injustices and are usually on the same page about the issues, but not always. In Vancouver, there was a guy named Bill Vanderzam, which is a super villain-ass name if I ever heard one. When I was about 7 or 8, he owned a big farm fair type place with a train and some rides and shit that you drive by on the way to the airport. All my friends loved to go. They'd have birthday parties there, but my parents banned me and my sister from ever stepping foot on his property. Bill Vanderzam was wildly conservative. He had tried to restrict abortion laws and campaigned to break up local labor unions, which really could not be more on brand for a man with the last name Vanderzam. My dad fucking hated him. We heard Bill Vanderzam was participating in one of those big Hanukkah lighting ceremonies that they do in cities sometimes, and my dad was pissed. As someone who believed Jews should be standing up against injustice and supporting unions and progressive agendas, he was being driven nuts by the whole idea of it. I remember my parents talking about going to the event.
"We have to go."
"I'm not going to go if you yell at him."
"There's just no point in going if I don't yell at him."
"Just don't go then."
"We have to go."
"We're not going if you make a big scene."
"I will make a big scene. I'll just make my protest in a clear and peaceful way. That's it."
"Fine. But if you go crazy, I pretend I have no idea who you are."
"Fine."
"Fine."
We hopped in our Chevy and drove a few minutes to a parking lot where a huge Hanukkah had been set up with a stage in front of it. There was a crowd of a couple hundred people standing around waiting for the ceremony to start. As men in suits took the stage and prepared to speak, my dad started getting riled up.
"There he is, that hypocrite. I hate him."
"All right, that's it. We're going over here now."
She grabbed me and my sister by the hands and started dragging us to the other side of the crowd. Then Bill Vanderzam took the mic.
Hello, and welcome to the Jewish ceremony celebrating...
You hypocrite!
Everyone in the crowd turned to see my dad screaming.
How dare you use the Jewish community to bolster your agenda? You don't care about oppression. You don't stand for anything progressive. You're a fraud!
Security came and started to kind of wrestle my dad away from the stage and out of the parking lot. A few local news crews were there to cover the event, and they ran over to my dad as he was being carted out. My mom turned to me and my sister and was like,
"Don't move. Just stand here. Act like you don't know him."
We did. We stared forward and watched the candle lighting as we heard my dad ranting in the background.
Hypocrite! How dare he? On the Festival of Lights, no less.
That night, we gathered around the TV to see if the event would be covered. I remember being very skeptical. But as soon as the local news started, the first headline plastered on the screen read, "Local man goes wild at holiday ceremony. Lead story." They showed footage of VanderZam taking the stage and then my dad screaming from the crowd.
What started as a celebration of our Jewish community ended as an attack on a local businessman. Moments after the ceremony began, Vancouver resident Mark Rogan had some words to share.
They cut to an interview with my dad where he went off on VanderZam. I looked over at him, watching. Couldn't have been happier. I looked back to the TV.
While many in attendance were obviously disturbed by the disruption.
It cut to shots of terrified members of the crowd watching my dad rant like a madman. It then cut to a shot of me, my sister, and my mother completely ignoring my father. The only ones in the entire crowd not looking in his direction.
This family somehow managed to be totally unfazed by the outburst.
A lot of my childhood revolved around food. Because of the Tourette's, I basically had ADHD, which is common. What wasn't common was my parents' approach to treating it. Instead of putting me on medication, they brought me to a behavioral dietitian who had this crazy thought that what you eat affects how you feel and behave. Basically, I didn't eat any dairy, wheat, or sugar of any type from ages 5 to 11 or so. The only fruit I could eat were pears, the lamest of fruit, because they have less sugar than all other fruit because they're so lame. Even their shape is outwardly mocked, and there's for sure foods with funnier shapes. Squash is the goofiest looking shit ever, which just shows how much people hate these fuckers. They're straight up getting picked on. I ate the most boring food on earth. The other kids love to make fun of me, always being like, "Don't eat a banana around Seth or he'll go fucking crazy," which really stung because it was kind of true. I mean, you could eat a banana around me, but if I had so much as a bite of one, I would go completely insane. My dad essentially grew up in his family's kosher butcher shop in New Jersey and is now a vegetarian, so it would take maybe 5 minutes of therapy to uncover why he is so specific about food. We always had separate plates for meat and vegetarian fare, but he had no problem preparing meat or being around it. My mom, who became a social worker and taught parenting skills, has a different quirk where she has a phobia of starving to death. She treats every outing like she's climbing Everest, planning around calorie intake, how many snacks per hour, tons of little baggies and backpacks with granola bars, jerky, crackers, Gorp, which is a funny word for trail mix. My mother must go through around 2.7 million Ziploc bags in any given calendar year. We would go out to eat a lot because nobody in my family had similar tastes, so it was impossible to cook family dinners. We didn't have a lot of money, but we lived in a big city, so we could find affordable restaurants with something for everybody. Or, should I say, affordable restaurant in the singular, because we pretty much only went to one at a time. We'd go there about 4 days a week until something made us move on to another restaurant. The first place I remember frequenting was called Bonanza, and the reason we stopped frequenting it is cemented in my head forever. We fucking loved Bonanza. It was a buffet-style place that was a 5% nicer version of Sizzler, which still makes it about 85% less nice than all other restaurants. They knew us there. They knew all my dad's super strange quirks. Diet soda, no ice, lemon on the side, extra napkins so he can wipe up the table himself throughout the meal. You know, OCD shit. It felt like a little haven for us, like Cheers, if it gave you terrible diarrhea every time you got home. Actually, maybe Cheers gave people diarrhea, who knows? They sure didn't emphasize it on the show, but it could have been going on in the background. Vancouver didn't have a ton of terrible snowstorms, but in 1990, the city was walloped. We carpooled to and from school with a few other kids from Richmond, which is a smaller city just outside Vancouver. My dad had dropped us off in the morning, and throughout the day, snow dumped down. By the time he came to get me, my sister, and the Josephsons, there were a few feet of snow on the ground. We piled into my dad's car, and as soon as we saw his face, we were spooked. He looked like he had just driven through some sort of Mad Max-style wasteland to pick us up. He was shook.
All right, buckle tight. It's crazy out there. These stupid drivers don't know how to actually drive in the snow because you have no seasons in this stupid city here. We will make it. Hold on.
If you haven't driven in a snowstorm, it's terrifying. You can't see shit, and the car doesn't do what you want it to do. We inched along Oak Street toward the bridge leading to Richmond from Vancouver in total silence, which is how my dad always drives. No radio, nothing.
Who can operate a vehicle with music blasting? Who can focus with all that noise?
Is something my dad likes to yell while he's driving.
Most of the idiots have gotten off the road. This is good. We're doing good. We're...
Suddenly, in the middle of the bridge, the car hit an ice patch and spun a full 360, slamming into the snow that had built up around the divider.
Holy moly, drat! All right, everyone okay?
We were.
All right, let's try to get off the bridge.
He inched down the back half of the bridge, and as soon as we crossed into Richmond, the roads were impassable. It started snowing harder and harder. He pulled over, sat for a second, staring off into space, then looked back at us.
All right, we can't drive anymore. That's it. We've got to abandon the car. We're miles from any of our houses. It'll take us hours to get there. But I think a half mile down that road, it'll be hard, but I think we can make it to Bonanza.
Everyone's eyes lit up. Salvation. With an all-you-can-eat buffet and soft-serve bar, which is also what they should have called the bathroom. Booyah!
All right, zip on your coats. I think we can do this. Let's move.
We followed my dad out of the car. The snow came up to our knees. Every step was an undertaking for our tiny bodies.
Come on, we can do it this way.
My sister was wavering.
Dad, no. I'm not going to make it. There's too much snow.
We'll make it. Bonanza's just around the corner. Don't give up. We're so close. You can order off the menu when we get there. Not just a buffet like usual. The actual menu.
Whoa, the actual menu? All right, let's do this.
We marched on, breathing hard. Our feet cold and our socks soaked.
We're almost there. Come on.
We gathered our energy and rushed to the corner. My dad raising his arms in celebration as we climbed over a wall of snow into the parking lot.
Yeah. It's right there. We made it.
He stopped in his tracks, his arms lowered to his sides.
No.
We turned and looked. There was Bonanza. Shades drawn. Lights out. A giant out-of-business sign plastered across its front doors. My dad dropped to his knees and bellowed to the heavens.
No!
It was gone forever. But thank God a Red Robin had opened nearby. And thank God even more that Red Robin had the brilliant idea to have unlimited French fries on their menu. From the ashes of disaster grew the roses of a new life. My mom and I were always close, which for a Jewish boy is probably the least surprising thing I could possibly write, other than saying that dairy messes with my tummy, which it also does. She's the only child of my insane grandparents, and somehow turned out to be considerate, progressive, level-headed, emotionally honest, and wildly weird at the same time. We became a lot closer in 1997 when we went to Israel together to visit Dania, who was living on a kibbutz for a year. We arrived and got in our rental car. Driving in Israel was totally crazy, and we had to make it all the way across the country, stopping in a hotel thing for a night along the way. My mom loves music. We blasted Sublime and A Tribe Called Quest the entire way. Again, it was 1997. Just be happy we weren't doing the dip. We arrived at the hotel, and it was not what we were expecting. Basically, it was a house. Thinking we were going to a hotel, but arriving at a house in the middle of nowhere was shocking, especially in a pre-Airbnb era. We approached the front door and knocked. A friendly Israeli man in his 50s answered the door.
Shalom, Baruch Falafel, Latke.
This is not what he said, but they are Hebrew words I know, so they'll do.
We don't speak Hebrew.
Shalom.
He gestured for us to follow him and led us through his house to a back room with two twin beds.
So we stay here in your house?
Kinnish, yes.
Okay, perfect, thanks.
The guy eyed us for a second.
No, not perfect. I make perfect Rosh Hashanah.
He then started awkwardly trying to push the two heavy metal bed frames closer together.
I fix, I make nice.
We protested. No, it's not necessary.
Please, no, they're fine where they are.
No, it's fine. I make one big bed for nice couple.
It was then it occurred to both me and my mother that this man thought we were in a sexual relationship with one another. Is not fine.
No, not fine.
Exactly, like this, not fine.
The Israeli made a sexually suggestive face to me.
I fix it, make it fine, Gal Gadot.
No, do not fix. We are not needing the fixing of anything.
It's fine. Matzo, I do not judge. It's fine.
He wouldn't take no for an answer. He kept pushing the two heavy beds closer and closer until they made one big bed in the middle of the room. Unfortunately, it would be easier just to move the beds back ourselves than it would be to convince this man we weren't just a shy couple. We laughed about it for the entire rest of the trip and still do. Nothing brings you and your mother closer together than having an Israeli innkeeper assume you're fucking one another. Sons of Commandments. Jews have a lot of odd traditions. They wear kippahs, which are funny little hats about the size of the palm of your hand. I'm not so sure, coincidentally, fit perfectly over a bald spot. Am I saying a major tenet of Judaism was formed to protect the vanity of balding Jewish men? Yeah, I am. They get circumcised, which I guess I've grown to have mixed feelings about. Do I have animosity toward my private parts? Not really. Do I sometimes wonder what it could have been like to have a penis that lived on in its natural state? Sure. I also think of my phantom foreskin out there somewhere, penisless. And then I think it's probably better off. I think a lot of Jews wonder what it would be like to experience a foreskinned penis. Is it better? Is it worse? Is it, in general, warmer? It would, by definition, be more penis, which is probably something every guy would be on board with. I've thought about starting a business where I sell prosthetic foreskins to Jews so they can feel what it would have been like to have non-Jew junk. It would be called Gentile Genitals, and it would make a fortune. When Jewish people turn 13, they have a bar or bat mitzvah, depending if you are a boy Jew or girl Jew, respectively. You get up on stage at temple in front of everyone you know and read from the Torah in a crazy sing-songy tune that I'm 100% sure has no musical logic to it in any way, shape, or form, which is objectively humiliating. To make things worse, you have to prepare for a fucking year for this shit. There are three good things about having a bar or bat mitzvah. One, a party. You get to have one after your service, and at that age, I'd been led to believe that having a party thrown in your honor is a fun thing, which is something I've since greatly reconsidered. Two, you get gifts, often in the form of money, which is the thing that I wanted to have to buy things I didn't have. A good haul could get you several $1,000s. That's right. All about the Binyamins, baby. I'm so sorry. And three, in order to have a bar bat mitzvah, you have to go to bar mitzvah class, which sucks, but you also have to be invited to all the bar bat mitzvahs of everyone in the class, and there were about 60 kids, so that's essentially an entire year of going to parties every single weekend, which was a pretty exciting prospect. I was entering high school the following year, and I had one goal. I wanted to have a girlfriend slash be a boyfriend, which I had never had slash been before. I'm not sure I really wanted a girlfriend for the right reasons. It wasn't sexual, as the idea of even taking my shirt off in front of a girl horrified me. I remember hearing about Orthodox people having sex through a hole in the sheet and thought, man, that would solve a lot of my problems. I wanted a girlfriend because I was scared shitless about going to high school, and I thought it would make me seem like less of a loser and therefore less likely to be eaten alive by older kids. It's like Edward Norton wanting all his friends to beat him up before he went to jail in the Spike Lee movie 25th Hour. Norton's character, Montgomery Monty Brogan, is about to serve a 7-year sentence for selling drugs. He figures he might as well go in there on the right foot, which in his case meant looking like a guy who had a proclivity for having the living shit kicked out of him, which I guess is a good thing in prison. Anyway, he had a scary situation ahead of him, and he did what he felt he had to do to prepare. Similarly, I thought, what better way to enter high school than in a relationship? Firmly staking my claim as an adult, I'll have social status, a teammate, and everyone will like and respect me, and my life will be great. Not the right reasons. At this age, the only way I knew to get a girlfriend was through dancing. And not just any dancing, slow dancing. It was the only way to really gauge how a girl felt about you, since actually talking about your feelings was unheard of. You would slow dance, and the closeness of your bodies indicated how likely you were to become a couple. If there was full body contact, you were dating. If there was grinding, you were essentially engaged. But in order to dance to a slow song, you first had to navigate a minefield of not slow songs. And you did not want to dance to a fast song with a girl. With guys, it was fine, and funny dancing was preferred. Luckily, it all became pretty predictable because every single bar bat mitzvah had the same DJ play the party with basically the same playlist. Nirvana was popular, and all the boys would mosh wildly to Smells Like Teen Spirit until Austin Bell got a concussion at Steven Glansberg's bar mitzvah and they stopped playing it. Cotton Eye Joe is by a Swedish band called Rednecks, whose gimmick was that they dressed up like the villains in Deliverance, which is an odd choice for a pop group. But say what you will, Cotton Eye Joe is a great song in a this song is not great, but fun to listen to for 2 years straight kind of way. I don't know if gimmick pop is a genre of music, but if it were, I'd be a fan. She Blinded Me with Science, Blue, Scatman, Barbie Girl. If there's an odd conceptual buy-in required to enjoy a pop song, I am your audience. Unfortunately, these types of bands don't always have longevity, and Rednecks themselves were haunted by the success of their only major hit. So much so that almost every other song on their album, Sex and Violins, which I purchased, sounded exactly like Cotton Eye Joe. There was a song called Old Poppin' an Oak that is so derivative, I'm tempted to say the Rednecks should be ashamed of themselves, but the truth is, I understand the pressure to give people more of what they want. That's how you wind up with movies like Neighbors 2. This one worked. Everyone loved it. They want more. Not new more, just more. I've been there, Rednecks. Neighbors 2 is the Old Poppin' an Oak to Neighbors' Cotton Eye Joe, and I honestly think I've experienced personal growth now that I've gotten that off my chest. But no song would create the controversy that was created by Monet Monet. Originally by Tommy James and the Shondells, and later covered by Billy Idol. I'm sure you know the song.
Here she come now singing Monet Monet.
Followed by three strong drum beats. Bop, bop, bop. And this pattern essentially continues for the rest of the song. Now, I couldn't tell you why or how, but for some bizarre reason, it became a tradition to fill in these bop, bop, bop with the words, hey, motherfucker, get laid, get fucked, over and over.
Here she come now singing Monet Monet.
Hey, motherfucker, get laid, get fucked.
Shoot it up, turn it up, come on, Monet.
Hey, motherfucker, get laid, get fucked.
And so forth for the entire 5 minutes and 2 seconds of the song, which is an obscene length for a song that repetitive. So, there's a lot of weird shit surrounding this phenomenon. One is, like I said, for the life of me, I could not tell you where this came from or why. There was no internet. None of us had been to a Billy Idol concert. We didn't even know who he was. It was just this bizarre thing, as though the collective consciousness was like, this song needs these words and we're gonna put them in there. I found an interview where Billy, first name basis, said that he heard it started in British frat houses in the late 80s. So how it made it to the Vancouver Jewish scene in the early 90s is beyond me. Obviously, the parents didn't like it. So they started to tell the DJ, before you play the song, warn the kids not to say the bad words and tell them if they say the words, you won't play it. He would.
Now, before I play Money Money, I just want to say that you should not say the thing you want to say during the song, or I will not play the song anymore.
I remember thinking, who gives a fuck? This song came out before we were born. The only reason we like it is because it gives us a chance to scream the word fuck at the top of our lungs, which is great. So if we can't do that, we don't need to hear this shitty song. Just play the redneck some more. That shit is great. But the real goal was a snow song. End of the Road and I'll Make Love to You, both by Boyz II Men, were great options. Can't Help Falling in Love by UB40 wasn't bad, but their bullshit quasi-Jamaican beats made them almost tread into fast music territory, so they were risky. Also, the fact that the world accepted a white British band that just did synthy reggae covers of other songs is truly fucking amazing in retrospect. Hands down, the ultimate slow song to feel out if you really had chemistry with another person was I Swear by All for One. And I swear by the moon and the stars in the sky, I'll be there, I'll be there. It's ironic that so many young Jewish men and women have their first feelings of intimacy sparked by what I've since learned is a decidedly Christian song. My Jewish elementary school had uniforms, so I'd never really had to decide what I wanted to wear. Bar and bat mitzvahs were my first chance, and I was jumping right to formal wear. We didn't have a lot of money, so pretty much everything would come from thrift stores, which Vancouver had many of, the best being a gigantic place called Value Village. I was a strange dresser, and I found fashion inspiration in odd places. I was obsessed with rap and hip-hop, so the only piece of clothing I had at this point, apart from my school uniform, was a black leather L.A. Raiders cap that I convinced my parents to buy me after I saw Ice Cube wear one in a magazine. But that wouldn't fly for a bar mitzvah, so I had to find inspiration elsewhere. The movie Tombstone came out in 1993, and while it wasn't a massive box office or critical hit, the New York Times called it morally ambiguous, it made an impression on many, mostly due to an amazing performance by Val Kilmer that was publicly praised by President Bill Clinton, which is the single most 90s sentence one could write. As 1994 rolled around, a young me was smitten with not only Val Kilmer's performance as Doc Holliday, but the entire Western aesthetic. The result? A fuckload of vests. I could not own enough vests. I'd have bought more torsos just to wear them all if it were an option. I loved me a vest. It packed me in, gave me shape, and most important, kind of made me feel like a cowboy who was dying of tuberculosis, which Val Kilmer had somehow made seem super awesome. I also wore a pocket watch, which, in a truly impressive act of delusion, I convinced myself was cool as fuck. It wasn't. Time after time, weekend after weekend, a slow song would come on, boys would ask girls to dance, girls would ask boys to dance, and I generally found myself standing on the side watching it all happen, spinning my pocket watch like some sort of 1920s mafia snitch. And again, it wasn't just the clothes. I was, in general, awkward, ill-motivated, and just not at the right level of maturity for any type of romantic relationship. I remember being at Julia Marinus's bat mitzvah, noticing two other guys also standing on the side, watching with longing as the other kids had fun. I'm one of those guys, I thought. What a fucking bummer. And then I noticed two other guys. They weren't standing on the side watching with longing. They actually seemed like they wanted nothing to do with the girls or the boys or the dancing or any of that. I knew them from bar mitzvah class. Their names were Sammy Fogel and Evan Goldberg, and I knew we'd be going to the same high school. Sammy was one of those 13-year-olds who looked like they're about 9 or 10. People called him Psycho Sam because he had a crazy temper. Evan was gigantic for his age and had sort of a baby Huey meets Homer Simpson-ish quality to him. He had this habit of yanking on the collars of his shirt so they were always all stretched out and saggy. I watched as they scavenged for discarded glow sticks, cutting them open, and pouring the glowing, noxious goop that was inside all over their hands. I went over.
What are you guys doing?
Pouring this glowing shit all over our hands and shit so they glow.
Awesome. Did you guys think I was splattering it all over your clothes? Then they'd glow too.
Vogel and Evan looked at each other, then back at me.
Fantastic idea.
Actually, I thought, I'm one of these guys. We spent the rest of the night, and many others, collecting glow sticks, cutting them open, and slathering ourselves with the highly toxic contents. We refocused our energy from dancing to slow songs, to drinking discarded beers and martinis, and smoking cigarette butts. A few times, I think, I even saw some of the other kids looking at us with longing. But then I swear would come on and they'd go dry hump while we slowly poisoned ourselves with glowing radioactive sludge. Up till then, all the friends I had were out of convenience. I hadn't really selected any. I was just near them all the time, so they were my friends. But me, Vogel, and Evan chose each other. The bar mitzvah year ended, and high school was next. I didn't feel ready. I was still scared of taking my shirt off. Scared of everything in general, really. But at least I wasn't alone. The Karate Yid. I started taking karate because I was afraid of getting beat up, which is ironic because pretty much all that happens in karate is you get beat up. I was obsessed with martial arts. Jean-Claude Van Damme, the Muscles from Brussels, was my favorite, followed very closely by Steven Seagal, who I think, even though he passes himself off as an Italian with the last name Seagal, is actually a Jew with the last name Siegel, which is great rebranding. I love the film Bloodsport, which, insanely, is allegedly based on the true story of Frank Dukes. It's about an American soldier. He's from Brussels in the movie, which is never explained, who enters the most elite underground fighting competition, the Kumite. The ultimate villain in the film was an actor named Bolo Jung, who is a bad guy in countless martial arts movies going back to Bruce Lee and was easily identified for having the biggest fucking pecs I've ever seen in my life. The dude was half pec. Over my bed, the last thing I saw before I fell asleep and the first thing I saw when I woke up was a poster from the film that featured Van Damme mid-jump kick nailing Bolo in the chest. The implication being that his kick was so strong, even those massive pecs were useless to stop it. I also loved The Karate Kid, which I related to more because, well, it's about a white kid who learns karate. In that film, Daniel LaRusso is being bullied by a group of kids in his high school who all do karate, but not just any karate, Cobra Kai karate, a dishonorable school of fighting that teaches truly unsavory techniques like the foot sweep. Daniel meets Mr. Miyagi, a bonsai salesman with a fucking dope-ass car collection, who ultimately teaches him the honorable way to fight, and he kicks the shit out of the Cobra Kai bully using an awesome crane kick. I was a soft kid, and I was generally scared. And by soft, I don't mean just like mentally soft. I was literally soft. I had a Pillsbury Doughboy quality to me. I seemed flaky and delicious, like you wanted to poke me and make me giggle. When I was about 7 years old, I was with my mom at the Vancouver Jewish Community Center, where she was taking an Israeli dancing class. When the class was over, I noticed a karate class starting in the same space, and I knew a kid in it. He seemed so psyched. I remember looking at the kids in their karate gi and being like, I fucking want that shit. My mom enrolled me and I met the teacher, who, thank God, was not Jewish. I'm not saying a Jewish dude wouldn't be a great karate teacher. Actually, yes, I'm 100% saying that a Jewish dude wouldn't be a great karate teacher. My teacher was Sean Ho, a Japanese-Canadian guy who was, simply put, the most badass motherfucker I've ever met in my life, and I owe a lot of my confidence to him. He was short, smaller than me. He was friendly, light, and funny. His age was literally impossible to tell, but I think he was in his 50s at the time, which is crazy. He seemed like he could take anyone out with the flick of a finger. We did Kyoko Shinkai-ken karate. Our motto was never give up, always do your best. A solid starting place in general. I learned a good lesson in karate, which was that just by not quitting, I'd progress. When I started, I was the worst of about 20 kids. After 2 or 3 years, I hung in there, and eventually everyone else who was ahead of me when I started dropped out of the class, and I became the highest-ranking student. Slowly, though, I started to realize that our school of karate maybe wasn't modeled on the ones I grew up watching in movies. Or at least not the school of karate that you were rooting for.
Never be afraid to foot sweep. If you have to, grab hair, gouge eyes, spit in their face, grab their balls and twist. Whatever you have to do to win.
Holy shit. I was in the Cobra Kai. My theory was really cemented when I was about 12 and we went to a tournament for the first time.
Why haven't we gone to more tournaments?
Oh, we're banned.
Oh, cool. Why?
Some stupid bullshit.
Cool. Anything I should know about this? Any special rules or anything?
Nope. Just win.
My first event was a sparring competition where I was facing off against a much bigger, older, and meaner-looking dude. I could tell just from how he bowed that his technique was much better than mine. He had crisp and explosive movement. The ref yelled for us to start, and the guy extended his arms and advanced on me, at which point I did a little trick I had where I smacked my opponent's arms out of the way with one hand and punched him in the throat as hard as I could with my other, which worked exactly as well as you'd think. The guy dropped to the ground, gasping like he was drowning. I raised my arms in victory, only to find the ref and judges looking at me with genuine rage.
Turn your back and kneel.
I was being publicly shamed as they checked on the other kid, who caught his breath after a few seconds. I got disqualified from the competition and went back to Sean, expecting to be yelled at.
I lost.
Sean motioned to the other kid, being tended to by his sensei. He smiled.
Doesn't look like it to me.
I was about to start high school, and again I'll say I was scared shitless. I'd gone to a Jewish elementary school, which was pretty sheltered and not at all diverse in that it was all Jewish kids. I would be going to public high school at Point Grey Secondary, which was across town and going to be very different. About 3,000 kids attended, and it was incredibly diverse, about 60% of the kids being from Asian countries. In Vancouver, there's no middle school, so grades 8 through 12 are all together, and that feels fucking insane if you're on the 8 end of that spectrum. It was like going to school with full-grown adults. There were kids with beards, like full fucking beards. There was a pregnant girl, which was so far outside what I was expecting. It was like if a minotaur went to high school with us. I was shocked. There were fights, stabbings, beatings, which seems odd for a high school in a lovely part of Vancouver's west side called Carisdale, but it happened. A few weeks into school, a kid was making a pipe bomb in shop class and blew his hand off. All to say, compared to Jewish elementary school, it felt like a lawless free-for-all. To add to the rough transition, like I said before, we'd always worn uniforms.